You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all of you who are joining us from your various time zones around the world. Thank you for coming to today's event. My name is Jenny Schutz. I'm a senior fellow at Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program and the Future of the Middle Class Initiative. I'll be moderating today's event on rental housing from around the world. Those of you who follow US housing markets are certainly aware that housing affordability has become an increasingly pressing problem, particularly for low and middle income households. The cost of housing is also becoming an increasingly salient political issue. If you've been paying attention to the many plans coming out of the Biden administration, you'll notice that there's a housing component both to the COVID relief package and to the infrastructure package. So housing affordability is not just a problem in the United States, though. Around the world, we've been seeing housing costs rising faster than income in many countries. And this puts a great deal of financial stress on low, moderate, and middle-income households. So to get some ideas about how other countries are dealing with this, Brookings Institution has partnered with a number of real estate scholars who study other countries. We wanted to get some insights into what was driving affordability issues and how other countries are dealing with it, including different ways that subsidies can be structured, tax policy can be used, and providing protections for renters. So we have brought together a terrific group of scholars. Any of you who've tried to do comparative research on housing markets across countries know that this is a really difficult thing to do. Housing markets are very much grounded in larger institutional and historical context. Things like the rule of law and the financial system and legal system affect housing markets. So in order to understand how policies work, we really need to bring that institutional context to bear on the research. In order to get a sense of what's going on currently with housing affordability and some of the policy responses to the pandemic, we have reached out to a number of really excellent scholars in their own field. So I'd like to go ahead and ask them to turn on their cameras and join us, and I will introduce each of them before we get into our conversation. Thank you. So I'd like to introduce each of the scholars who wrote a case study that forms the basis for today's webinar. Arthur Acolin is an assistant professor of real estate at the University of Washington, and he was the author of the case study on France. We also have then Christian Hilber, who is a professor of economic geography at the London School of Economics, and he co-authored the case study on the UK, along with his author, Olivia Cherny. Caroline Schmidt is a senior teaching associate in real estate finance and economics and a Land Society fellow at Cambridge University, and she authored the case study on Germany. Elisabeth Villacadens-Marsal is a professor at the University of Barcelona and a researcher at the Barcelona Institute of Economics. Elisabeth, along with her co-author Gislain Uzba, wrote the case study on Spain. And finally, we have Jiro Yoshida, who's an associate professor of business at Penn State University and a guest associate professor at the University of Tokyo, and he authored the case study on Japan. Thanks to all of you for being here today and for your outstanding work on the case studies. Excellent. So for the audience members, we're going to have a moderated Q&A amongst the panel for about 40 minutes. And so we have some questions prepared for that. Then we'll transition to having a Q&A based on some of the questions that you all have submitted. And I believe you got a chance to submit questions in advance when you registered for this. You can also put additional comments and questions into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom screen. And please join in the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag rental housing. You can flag questions there that will get funneled back to us during the Q&A session. So I want to start off by just setting the stage with a pretty broad question for all of the panelists. One of the really fundamental differences that we learned from reading these case studies is that just the ecosystem of rental housing looks very different in different countries. Even something as fundamental as who are the providers of rental housing, who owns this, who are the landlords, influences then the kinds of rental housing and also the kinds of policies that countries can adopt. So for instance, in the United States, the vast majority of rental housing is owned by private for-profit entities, and that's split both between large companies, entities like real estate investment trusts and asset managers, but also quite a large number of units are owned by individuals or families, so what we refer to in the U.S. as mom-and-pop landlords. Subsidized housing in the U.S. is a very small share of overall rental stock. It makes up less than 10% of rental homes. And subsidized housing is held both by public entities, local housing authorities, but also by nonprofit and for-profit landlords as well. So this is sort of the landscape in the U.S., but I'd like to start with each of you just in turn telling us a little bit about who are the major providers of rental housing, who are the owners of rental housing in each of the countries. And I'll start to my left in the Zoom box with Arthur and then go to Elizabeth after that.
Thank you, Jenny. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to acknowledge that I'm speaking from the campus of the University of Washington in Seattle, and so acknowledge I'm occupying the land of the Coast Salish people, including all tribes and bands within the Suquamish, Tulalip, and Muckleshoot nations that have been in the region from historical times. Affordability is a big issue here, but in France, it's a very different landscape. About 40% of households are renters, and among them, almost half are renting social housing that is owned either by public authorities or municipal level public housing authorities or housing associations that are public-private partnership with an important role for employers in financing and managing some of those housing stock. Among the 57% of the rental stock that is owned by private landlords and rented without social housing restriction, about 94% of that stock is owned by small scale individual or family that are owning less than five units. And also generally own, even for apartment building condos, so an apartment building will not have a single owners in most cases, but be subdivided between individual owners, which creates this really decentralized, diffuse ownership structure that is very different from the corporate ownership structure that might be familiar to US audiences.
Great, thanks. Elizabeth, would you like to go next?
Thank you very much, Jenny, for having me here today. Let me start saying one important thing for the audience, that Spain is a country with one of the lowest rentership rates along the European countries. Today, less than one in four households are renting their home. So we are talking about small numbers here in Spain. From these small numbers of people renting housing, a very small part is social housing. This was not the case in the past. I mean, if you go back 50, 60 years ago, the rental market was about half and half compared to the homeowner market. So Spain has been facing a very big change in terms of the amount of people renting or owning their home. So this small market, I would say this small rental market, is basically composed by non-professional landlords. So basically rental housing is owned by individuals. This is changing a bit lately because a few big international companies are entering into the market to develop and manage the rental market in Spain for two reasons. Basically, recently the rental business is more profitable than before. And second, the public sector introduced some fiscal incentives to attract these companies to do business in Spain. But even with these companies running part of the market, they represent just 10% of the rental market, concentrated in the biggest cities and also related to this short-term rental housing market. So today, still, most of the control of the market in the rental housing is in the hands of these non-professional landlords.
Thank you. Jiro.
Hi, thank you for having me. For Japan, about 60% of housing stock is owned, owner-occupied. So home ownership rate is 60%, and home ownership is supported by public low-interest long-term mortgage program. The remaining 40% is rental housing. And what's unique about Japanese rental housing stock is that they are really small. The average size of rental units are only 50 square meters on average. And the most prevalent type is studio apartment with less than 30 square meters. So actually, I'm using a picture of a very typical studio apartment in Tokyo in my background. It is called a one-room mansion in Japan. It's kind of oxymoron. But anyway, the reason is obviously due to tight land supply, but also it is an economic consequence of strong tenant protection, which I can talk about later. Then among rental housing, public and quasi-public rental units account for 14%. Then those public units are very popular and almost fully occupied. So there's a rationing for those public units in Japan. Then the remaining private rental units, they are mostly owned by individuals. 80% of private rental units are owned by individual owners, and they are mainly motivated by tax advantage. In particular, individuals can get a huge inheritance tax advantage or reduction by owning rental properties instead of financial assets. So that creates an incentive to own rental property, especially a smaller one, as I will talk later. So this is kind of overview of Japanese market.
Great, thank you. Christian.
First, thank you for having me. So let me start by saying that the majority of people in the UK own their property, actually very similar to the US. In fact, the home ownership rate is very similar to the US with 64%. The remaining housing stock is roughly equally divided between social rental housing and private rental housing. And the landlords of the social housing stock are either so-called local authorities or councils or housing associations. And housing associations are private, non-profit organizations that receive public funding. And on the private rental side, the landlords are typically individuals. Roughly half of these individuals purchase these properties via buy-to-let mortgages. And institutional investors are in the UK still very rare. However, recently, there has been a slight increase with so-called build-to-let initiatives, so where institutional investors get more active in the private rental market.
Excellent, thanks. Caroline, finish us off.
Thanks, Jenny, for inviting me as well. I think it's really great to have this comparison overview of all the rental markets. So I think Germany is probably another extreme case because our homeownership rate is so low. So only around 45% of households own their home and 55% are renters. And this has been like that for quite a while. So after a lot of the housing stock was destroyed in World War II, there were many homeless people, many displaced people and refugees as well. And this has created a strong new construction of rental housing. And so from within the rental housing sector, roughly 60% of the units are owned by private landlords, and that can be individuals or communities of heirs. And that's typically families who own a home together that they have inherited and administer it together. But also homeowners associations. And this is typically the case in high-rise buildings where everyone owns just one unit, but they own the building together and have to operate it together. And so this is 60% of the units, and around 20% is owned by cooperatives, roughly 15% only by real estate firms. And that can be building societies or asset managers, developers, or firms that own employee housing, for example. And then the remaining 5% is owned by the public sector. And I have to mention, this is all self-reported data by renters. The last time that this was collected officially was in the census, and that was 10 years ago. So the real numbers may slightly differ, but I think on average, it's still correct.
We could have an entire seminar talking about how hard it is to get good data on the rental housing market. I think I'm probably safe to say that rental housing is understudied and underdocumented in a lot of the official data sources, which makes this research that much more complicated. Excellent. So I think that probably gives our audience a sense of some of the things that are driving differences. So we already see kind of historical trends and things that have shaped the market over time, that there have been some changes. The role of the public sector in directly owning and providing social housing is quite different, which we'll get into shortly. Some differences in things like mortgage finance and in tax policy. So Caroline, I wanted to start with you. Germany obviously stands out as having the highest rentership rate. It's the only majority renter country of the six that we studied. And in your case study, you talk a little bit about some of the tax policies that may contribute to that. So can you give us a little bit of an overview of what the tax benefits are for renters or tax benefits for owning rental housing that might incentivize people to rent out properties?
Yeah. So unlike in other countries, we don't have this tax incentive for owner occupation. So if you own and occupy your own home, you cannot deduct mortgage payments from your taxable income. Instead, you can deduct it from your income if you rent the unit out to someone else. So, this is the first thing, I think, which is the strongest incentive for landlords to purchase a rental unit and rent it out. But they can also pass on, for example, land value tax to the renters or certain repair and maintenance costs, such as cleaning services and janitors, and also depreciation of the building and other utilities like water supply, for example. So all this doesn't really, all this is really incentives for rental housing. This is probably also the reason why many landlords rent out units in their own buildings, because then it's easier to monitor their investment and share the cost of the entire home. And then there's also kind of a special depreciation, which is more a temporary measure. So for newly created living space, there is a special depreciation where you can have higher deductions for a certain time, but also this is bound to certain requirements. So you have to rent out this unit again for at least 10 years.
Great. Yeah, the US has had conversations and changes over time in our federal tax treatment of rental housing. So it's good to notice that it really matters, right? Tax policy has some big implications for this. I want to turn now to Christian and Arthur together. So both of you talked a fair amount in your case studies about the role of social housing, social rental housing, but France and the UK are going in very different directions, right? So in the UK, social housing has decreased as a share of overall the housing market, and France is continuing to invest in social housing and in some ways try to fix things that haven't worked as well in the past. So I'd love to hear from both of you, and maybe Arthur, you want to go first. Tell us a little bit about the role of social housing in the rental market and kind of significant changes in the past few years.
Yeah, and so France has had a mixed history with social housing, and that's probably an understatement. Some of you probably have seen some of the image and are familiar with the housing estate that were built on the outskirts of large French cities in the post-World War II era. And some became really ghetto in terms of having really concentration of poverty, huge social issues. And that history is still present. A lot of those housing estates are still there and there have been a lot of effort put into redeveloping them. But one of the big thing I want to emphasize with regard to France is that right now we have about 4.5 million units of social housing, which is almost exactly the same number of housing units than in the US when you combine public housing and LIHTC program. So about 4.5 million as well, except that France is only one-fifth of the size of the US. So we have a really large social housing stock. And almost 1.8 million of those 4.5 million units were built within the last 20 years. So yes, we still have that history of what was built in the 50s, 60s, but we have also a much more recent stock. And that stock, to a large extent, has tried to be a lot more integrated to the urban fabric, a lot more mixed income. There's a recent paper in Housing Policy Debate touching on that for those interested, where really France has, since 2000, and a law that was passed that requires every municipality above a certain size to provide at least 20% of their stock as social housing, now 25%. That has really tried to make it more dispersed across the territory and have more of a balance of where social housing is located. There are still a lot of issues with regard to municipalities not complying with that mandate and choosing to pay a fine rather than performing, particularly, as you can imagine, wealthier municipalities that really don't want low-income housing within their jurisdiction or very small quantity of it. But overall, there is still this commitment to public housing and to having it available in areas of opportunities in higher job growth areas. So social housing is not a residual sector in France. And one of the examples for that is if you look at the income distribution among renters who are in the three median household decile, so earning between around median income, almost half of them are in social housing. So if you're a renter earning median income household, there's a pretty good chance that you will be in social housing. So it's a very different view of social housing than in the US. And I don't have time to get into that, but the other really important component is that we also have universal rental assistance. So we don't only have social housing place-based policy, but we also have universal rental assistance on the private rental side, which also allows to have affordable housing being spread across neighborhood and across municipalities. But hopefully we can come back to that in the Q&A if interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Christian?
Yeah, so the story for the UK is different, as you already mentioned. So in the UK, social housing actually increased in importance until 1980. And in 1980, roughly one third of the entire housing stock was social housing. But then Margaret Thatcher implemented the so-called right to buy policy, which gave the owners of social rental units the right to purchase their units at a heavily discounted price. And, you know, everybody who can afford to buy those social rental units, of course, took advantage of this. And as a consequence of this, the share of the rental stock decreased quite significantly from around a third to around 18% today. And correspondingly, the share of owner-occupied housing had increased at least until 2003. So one consequence of this decline in the social rental stock is that the waiting list to qualify for this social housing has become even longer. And despite criteria that in principle give preference for the most vulnerable in our society, in practice, sadly, it is often those most vulnerable that end up on the street and become homeless.
Great. I have to say, as a loyal watcher of The Crown, I'm now very disappointed that they didn't have a special episode talking about right to buy. I feel like that would have been a really great conversation for the private audience to talk about the future of social housing. So suggest that for another episode. So I want to turn now to Giro and Elizabeth and ask you to pull out a little bit from your case study. You both talked about the role of the national government in regulating leases. And some ways that either currently or in the past, Spain and Japan have made it hard for landlords to end a lease, even when the lease sort of seems to come to an end. And so the difficulty of kind of completing a relationship and turning stock over. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that happened and then maybe explain some of the incentives that creates for landlords.
I can start if you want, Jenny. Okay, so as I told you, in Spain, the rental market is kind of small, but it was not the case in the past. But the role of the public sector has been basically regulating the market, not investing a dollar on building new housing for public renting, okay? So the regulations were like in my opinion, we have seen a collection of failures, laws trying to organize the market and not being successful. For example, I can go back to the 60s, where as I told you before, the rental market was not that small as it is today. And there was a law that was protecting the tenants like forever. So the law requires the landlord to extend the lease until the tenant dies, or if he wants. And after the tenant death, the spouse or the children can assume the lease. So in the end, this was a disaster because this decreased a lot the profitability of the landlords. So the supply of new rental units was basically decreasing a lot. 35 years later, so during 25, we got this fantastic law that protecting, like, in my opinion, too much the tenants, so supply of rental housing going down. So they changed the law, they removed this mandatory extension, and they started kind of a crazy collection of laws saying then the lease could be an agreement between two parts, and now the lease has to be 3 years, and now 5 years. So in the end, the years were passing by, the amount of renters were going down, and we arrived until the year 2019, where they decided again to make it difficult not to get the tenant out, because now the lease are controlled, so they have a duration. But they started with the other side of the story, introducing rent control. So we started with the lease control, and we finished the story of Spain with the rent control, that if we have time later on, I can tell you about how it's working in Spain, this new invention on how to not spending a dollar on the rental market, but trying to regulate it like crazy with not a successful story, I would say.
Great, thanks, Shiro.
Yes, like in Spain, Japanese legal system also provides strong tenant protection. In particular, there are two types of lease contracts, ordinary leases and fixed term leases. And the very common, most common ones are ordinary leases, and they provide strong tenant protection. For example, even though there's a contract term, tenant can renew a lease indefinitely, and or tenant can terminate the lease in the middle of the lease contract. In contrast, a landlord cannot easily terminate the lease in the middle or even refuse renewal, because in order for a landlord to refuse the renewal, they have to file a lawsuit and establish a just cause at the court. That's really, really difficult. And furthermore, renewal rents for sitting tenants are typically very low, much, much lower than the market rent. So that creates a very similar situation as in rent control in the US and other countries. So there are several important consequences out of that tenant protection. First, a property owner is really cautious and concerned about the sitting tenant problem in renting a property to someone else, right? So when a tax-motivated individual starts to build rental properties, they try to select a particular kind of tenants who are not likely to renew leases, meaning that those tenants are college students, those tenants can be young professionals. So in order to attract those short tenure tenants, they build studio housing. So the supply of studio housing less than 30 square meters is huge in Japan in order to avoid sitting tenant problem. That creates a weird supply demand mismatch problem in Japan. So that's a tenant protection situation in Japan.
Yeah, that's fascinating how the regulation of leases, and I hadn't thought about it until your case study, that long-term leases, in some senses function like rent control, right? If you can't you can't increase the rent that much with a sitting tenant, you have to wait for it to turn over. But if the lease can be extended indefinitely, then you never actually get a chance to raise the rent. So it's sort of backing into rent control. Excellent. So I want to ask one more question of all of the panelists. And this is, you get to put on your imaginary hat. So we're going to pretend that each one of us gets to be the housing czar in charge of housing policy for your country. And you're given a magic wand that you can just wave and change any of the policies that you think are most essential that would make the rental market work better. So one or two things that would make a real difference to the market. And we get to pretend that we don't have to worry about political concerns. We don't have to worry about money. We just get to change policies the way we as economists think they should work. So I'll give an example for the U.S. There are two things that I think are most important to make U.S. rental markets work better for both for tenants and for landlords. The first is to loosen the zoning regulations, the local government laws, which currently make it very hard to build multifamily buildings that provide a lot of the rental housing. So we need to make it easier and faster and cheaper to build apartments, particularly in the places where there's very high demand and people want to live there and there just isn't enough supply. And that should be paired with something that Arthur mentioned earlier that's common in France, which is providing rental housing to all low-income households as a matter of right. So currently, Congress has an annual appropriation, decides how much money to spend on household-based rental vouchers, and most people who qualify don't get a rental voucher because they run out of money. So if we allow more supply and give money to low-income households, that would substantially alleviate a lot of the housing affordability problems in the U.S. So we'll go in reverse order on this one. We'll start with Caroline and then Christian.
Okay, so I think I agree with you that building or construction should be made, raised more quickly. I think in Germany, the total number of dwellings is sufficient. The problem is just that they're in the wrong place. So the literal translation of real estate in Germany is really immobile. And if I could use my magic wand, I would probably just take the homes that are in the wrong place and just put them where they're needed, even though I don't think this is what you actually meant. So I would probably also say that new construction has to happen more quickly, so that the building code in Germany is far too complex. It's much too strict. I think there are other countries that make that much better, for example, the Netherlands. And also land is too expensive. So if we could build more housing more quickly, this would help a lot, especially in the urban centers where most people are really moving at the moment. And my other wish would be to have better data on not only on the rental market, but also on the owner-occupied market. Because this, I think we have even less data for homeowners than we have for rental markets. And it would help tremendously to make better policy recommendations if we just had more information about who lives where and what kinds of investors are active in the different markets.
Christian, do you want to go next?
Okay, so let me first give a 30 seconds background of the institutional setting in Britain before I answer the question. So the main problem in Britain is lack of house building, which has led lack of house building, particularly in the most desirable parts of the country, the Greater London Authority and the South East. And this has led to skyrocketing house prices and rents, especially in these desirable areas. And so housing has, especially owner-occupied housing, but also private rental housing has increasingly become unaffordable for young people, lower incomes, but increasingly also middle incomes. And the underlying cause of this is arguably a dysfunctional planning system and a tax system that gives virtually no incentives to local authorities to permit residential development in the first place. And then together with NIMBYism, this just leads to very little new construction. So as a consequence, and now answering your question, what I would do as a housing czar is I would reform the planning and the tax system to make it easier to build, thereby reducing the costs of housing and improve affordability for everybody, but in particular for young people, lower incomes and middle income who struggle the most. And if I may add, on the rental side, I would actually slightly improve the protection of private renters without actually introducing any kind of strict rent control. So I think that's, I wouldn't want to go nearly as far as Spain or Japan, but there is somewhere an optimum. And in England, one issue, or in the UK, one issue is that there is virtually no protection of renters. And I think there is somewhere an optimum, and the UK is to the left of it. And we should move a little bit more towards protecting renters. The idea is to make the long-term rental option more a better alternative. And at the same time, not to disincentivize landlords to provide private rental housing in the first place. And just to be clear on this, I would opt to maintain social housing and or social benefits for the most vulnerable of our society. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a great point that there is essentially this balancing act between providing enough protection for renters, particularly the most vulnerable renters, without making rental housing financially unattractive to landlords, right? So there's definitely a spectrum there. We get the sense that every country is trying to find its place there. I may come back with a follow-up question on property taxes, because it's not something that we talked about in the case studies, but I want to do a quick survey later. But why don't we go to Jiro next?
Okay. Yes, for Japan, I would definitely change the balance of tenant protection. As Christian emphasized, probably the ideal or optimal point is in the middle of no protection, the heavy protection. And so on the one hand, tenant protection provides stability and security to renters, and it's good. It's an intention of the legal system. But on the other hand, in equilibrium, strong protection results in undersupply of rental units, especially for families, right? So in Japan, a family doesn't have many choices other than borrowing money and owning a house, because there aren't many rental housing provided for families, right? Then borrowing is not necessarily a happy solution to those households, because mortgages are recourse in Japan, and that's a really heavy burden to those households. And also, there are so many vacant units wasted or unused because they are concerned about sitting tenant problem. So there's a waste of resource and mismatch of stock, supply and demand for housing. So instead of imposing universal tenant protection, it would be much better to have the transparent pricing of many of the contracts, like with a better protection of tenants or longer lease term or renewal rights with without renewal rights and so on. Then if we have a different pricing for those, then that would create a much, much better or more complete market for rental housing. That would be my recommendation.
Elizabeth?
Okay, so thinking about Spain, if I see what's going on, I mean, after 2015, we have seen an important increase on the rents, because, I mean, it was more difficult to get a mortgage to pay a new house, and also young people have less stability on the job market, so more people wanted to rent, more demand, and the supply was not growing at the same path. So the point is that we need to increase supply as much as possible in the rental market. So, and because we need to increase supply, I would say that the public sector is the one that is in charge to providing now forever social public housing, because we don't have, I told you that it was less than 2%. You told us there's not a money constraint in this policy you are now creating. I would say produce, build social housing in Spain, because it's what we need, because the people that was more affected by this increase in the prices was, of course, young and low-income people. So they need social housing. If we don't have this big amount of money to build the housing, we can be creative and invent some fiscal incentives for the new tenants to provide new units and to arrange not so high price for a long-term lease. So we can be creative with this. This would be my thing, increase supply basically from public money and create new buildings. And second, going back to Jenny's point about zoning, about land use policies, in Spain, we also have some problems here, as all of us we have. The land use policies in hands of the tiny municipalities. We have more than 8,000 municipalities each one does what they want, and we need coordination. So another thing that I could do if I was able was try to motivate coordination or make it compulsory, because you cannot imagine how difficult it is for these tiny units to decide which piece of land is developed, which other is not developed. And in the end, it's not an efficient market of providing the land that is needed for this new housing to be built.
Great. Arthur.
Yes. So France, one other thing is already spending a lot of money on rental housing, which is really a big difference from the US. And so I wouldn't probably want to increase how much is spent on public housing. We are currently spending about 1.5% of GDP on rental housing, both public social housing and rental assistance. That's about six times as much as what the US is allocating to all rental housing programs as a share of GDP. And so there is a lot of money spent on it. And there are some results that I think are pretty good. Like if you look, for example, at rent burden for the lowest income quintile, about 20% of private sector renters cost burden in France, it's more than 50% in the US at the same income level. So there are some outcomes I think that are pretty good from that spending. We also have pretty stable renters. On average, the median length of residence is 6 years in France. So it's about three times as long as in the US. So the outcomes, I think, for renters are pretty good. But there are still also a lot of things that are not working on the regulation side. And so enforcing the SRU law that requires to have at least 20 or 25% of public housing, particularly in tight labor market, tight rental market, I think is really important so that you have affordable housing in areas of opportunities. So that would be one. And then the second one, France still pretend to be a race-blind country and doesn't recognize discrimination based on origin. And so taking more steps to making sure that both private and public landlords don't discriminate based on origin would be another step that I think is really important. That's not something we really discussed in some of those case studies, but is really important. And then the third one we only had is to remove some of the steps that have been taken towards rent control. Rent control has been kind of that element of the public debate that hasn't gone really far yet, but a number of cities have started implementing it. Germany is often cited as one of those examples of what to do in that regard, and so Caroline can comment on that. But I really think that the price signal and the rent signals are really important to bring in landlords, to bring in development, and going down the route of the rent control would have damaging long-term consequences on just that equilibrium in the rental market right now.
And I'll go ahead and plug, Arthur has a paper that's been put out that tests for discrimination in the French rental market based on the name of the renter who's submitting it. So with the equivalent of Craigslist, they submitted some applications and there is a substantial amount of discrimination based on perceived country of origin. So you should read that. Caroline, I'm going to throw that over to you since Arthur brought up rent control. And Berlin's rent control program has been making news in the last week. So do you want to give us a quick recap of what the setup was and what's recently happened from the court cases?
Yeah. So I think it was at the beginning of last year when Berlin introduced a rent break. So it wasn't able to raise rents at all. And this has been ruled unconstitutional last week. And the reason for this was that there is already rent control in Germany. And so there cannot be additional rent control on top of this. And the policies that we have in place already, that's also kind of a rent cap. And it implies that you cannot raise the rent of your lease by more than 10% on top of the local average rent index, let's say. And it has been ruled unconstitutional. And there has also been research on this rent break that said that, people tended to move out of Berlin into other large cities like Potsdam, which is like a satellite city. And also the number of listings for rental units has decreased a lot because who would want to move out of a unit when there is already a rent control. So people didn't want to move anymore. And that significantly decreased labor mobility as well. And labor mobility is a really important topic in Germany, because this is basically what decides or what determines rentership in Germany.
I want to go back to a topic that that Christian had brought up. He raised the issue of taxes and incentives for local governments. In most of the countries, local governments have at least some authority over allowing properties to be built or not built. In the US, this raises some real issues too. New housing is perceived as a fiscal burden on local governments because local governments are responsible for paying for services. In particular, schools are mostly funded by local governments here. And so the perception is if you build a bunch of apartments that bring in families with school-age kids, that has to generate enough in locally collected property taxes to pay for the cost of services, right? So there's a real tension, particularly about providing family housing for lower income families. And that creates at least some of the pushback. We can distinguish a little bit between NIMBYism, not wanting low income neighbors, versus a local government worried about the fiscal consequences. So I'd be curious to hear each of you talk about, is housing considered a fiscal burden on local governments? Or do you fund public services differently? And does that somehow alleviate the pressure? And Christian, I'll throw it to you first since you raised this.
Yes, I think this is a really important point, because if you look at the UK, the problem, or one of the key problems, is that local authorities, they have all the cost of providing infrastructure and local public services. If you allow a bigger housing project in your local area, that makes the school catchment area smaller, it leads to more congestion in the road, it leads to more pollution. NIMBY residents don't like it. And then on top of that, local authorities have all the cost of this development. They have to provide the infrastructure and the public services, but they have very few benefits. There is a council tax, but it's a very small tax. So essentially, local authorities have disincentives to permit development. And that's one of the issues, because they have the power to permit the development. And as a consequence, you see very little permission to build residential housing. And if I may throw in a seventh country, if you compare this to Switzerland, which has very strong taxation power at the local level. So in Switzerland, you have local income taxes, and everybody tries to attract Roger Federer to move to their, local municipality. So local authorities, they zone land at the outskirts of their municipalities, large parcels, to attract good taxpayers. And so this is really important. In Switzerland, this has led to a perceived sprawl problem, and policy is trying to tackle the sprawl problem. Whereas in the UK, where you have these disincentives to permit development, it leads to a massive affordability problem, especially in desirable areas like London.
Do any of the rest of you want to talk about sort of the local tax issue or local services? Is that an issue for you as well?
If I can add something. In Spain, the local city councils are kind of small in terms of the amount of money they manage. For example, they don't run education. But the peculiarity here is that around 20% of the budget is related to the housing activity. So in some cases, there is the temptation of the local politician to allow more building, more development, to get the taxes related to these new buildings, to this new construction. And we did a paper some years ago trying to understand the housing booms and bust at the local level. And it's clear to see how some local authorities took the wrong decision, increasing the amount of development they allowed to pick the money related to construction. Then they hire more people. And when the crisis came, they were in trouble. Some of them were bankrupt because they were not able to keep the city council because they grew too much. So in Spain, we have this, and we are talking not about big amount of money, but the proportion of the budget is very related to this type of activity. So this is kind of a problem sometimes in Spain. True.
I would add a perspective from Japan. Japan is a fast aging country, and the concern by local governments are not really the burden by, you know, school system and so on, but a shrinking population in the regional area. In Japan, still population are migrating into Tokyo, meaning that other regions have a severe shrink in population. So they like to increase, they like to have houses, they like to have, you know, population. And then local governments, yes, tax revenue is coming from property tax for local governments, but in Japan, tax rates and tax assessments are governed by the national government. So each jurisdiction doesn't have any discretion on that part. So that's not really a big issue for local government. So, you know, they don't have any choices and they just want to have more population.
It's really fascinating to hear that there are countries where property taxes are set at the national level and that there are places where the national government pays for schools. That's sort of the, you know, baked into the US housing system and creates a lot of these distortions. So we had a question from one of the audience members asking about sort of the distinction between the kind of small individual landlords and the larger corporate landlords in countries where both of these exist, sort of how different are these sectors, right? So in the US, a lot of it comes down to the size of the property. The really big multifamily buildings tend to be owned by large corporate owners, REITs or asset managers. And you know, smaller individual mom and pop landlords tend to own small buildings, single family, you know, 2 to 4 family primarily. And so then that sort of takes you down the road of the buildings are different, you know, the amenities they offer are different. But I'm curious in other countries, you know, how different are these sectors? Is the individual landlords and the corporate landlords, do they really have different products?
Let me start. In Japan, what's interesting is that individual property owners are motivated by tax incentives. So their pricing is very different from professional investors' pricing. So individual owners are willing to pay high price. That creates a really low investment yield for properties. So recently, REITs are trying to increase their portfolio in apartments and residential properties. But those professional investors cannot really compete with individual owners in terms of pricing because individual pricing is very different from investment purpose pricing.
And in France, what is interesting with some of those individual landlords is that they're actually programmed, that they're really targeting them because of the fiscal incentive as well. And so you have entire buildings that are built with that particular program. And those programs change with almost every government. So developers really adapt to it. And so that's produced for renting, but sold as individual units. And so you can see kind of that typology of housing. While the institutional tended to really be focused on some of the core markets in the large cities like Paris, Lyon, or Marseille. So they really don't have a lot of institutional that have smaller building in not core market. The other thing with some of the corporate is that they are subject to different regulation. So they have to have 6-year lease instead of 3-year leases, for example. So there are some differences for the tenant in that regard and for the landlord. But overall they are not operating in the same market or with the same building as well.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So in Germany, we private individuals really have different products than professional landlords. I would say that for private landlords, so individuals, for example, they tend to own buildings with more rooms. So probably single family homes, which they just rent out. This could be an inherited home. But they may not want to sell it and just live elsewhere, probably in a rental home. The dwellings or the buildings where these private individuals own rental homes tend to be the buildings tend to be smaller. So typically the real estate firms own units in high rises, for example. In Frankfurt, all the new construction in the city center is high rises, and these are all constructed by professional landlords. Of course, these tend to be also much smaller than single family homes, which are primarily rented out by mom and pop rent landlords. I think professional landlords in the cities can make quite good money of these smaller units as well by just renting out the top level units at a higher, much higher rent, and the lower ones at lower rents.
For Spain, as I told you before, these professional landlords are a very small part of the market, just on average 10%. But in big cities like Barcelona, maybe it could be 20-25%. And usually the way they work is that these international companies, they buy the whole building, they renew the building, and they open these new flats, fancy flats for the new tenants in the city. And as I told before, sometimes this is related to these short-term rentals. So it's a different type of, the tenant is not the same as the one that is usually renting from an individual owner.
So I'm curious, a couple of the countries have different also lease structures, right? So in the US, the standard is a one-year lease and then you renew for another year. Jiro, you had talked about there are two different kinds of leases in Japan, both sort of a more open-ended and a fixed term. In your countries, if there is a multi-year lease, how does that typically work with rents? Is there a rent increase that's built in? So sort of like, corporate leases in the US, like a retailer office, you would have a stepped up increase that's agreed on or linked to an index. But for multi-year leases, how does the rent work?
So yeah, in France, generally, both at renewal, so every 3 years at renewal, you have an index you can use for increasing your rent at renewal. And in some cases, it's also indexed during the length of the lease as well with a step. I just saw a Q&A question I wanted to address as well with regard to rent moratorium in the context of COVID. In France, at baseline, you can't evict anybody for almost any reason from the beginning of the winter to the end of the winter. And with COVID, they have extended it until the end of June last year and this year again. So we have very strong protection against eviction during the winter. And even outside of the winter, it's still pretty difficult to evict in general. So, and so that's, with regard to COVID, that has really changed that dynamic relative to the US.
Just following up on that. So in the UK, actually, one-year leases are extreme. They are the typical form. And I think longer term leases are extremely uncommon. And I mean, that's why I emphasized renter protection a little bit, because that has caused a lot of problems, in particular because most of the private rent units are owned by landlords who own only one single unit, and they often not very well trained and don't know the laws very well. And so you see it sometimes that landlords increase the rent massively from 1 year to another due to personal circumstances and things like that. And but just following up, like when COVID hit the country, the government also introduced protection of eviction so that this can't happen.
So in Spain, when you have these leases that have a length that some multi-years, you apply every year the increase of the national inflation rate, which it's a lot of debate, because as you can imagine, prices are not growing the same in all geography, but the rate is the same for all the leases. That's one thing. And this has been a big debate. You cannot increase the same in Barcelona as in the smallest town in the middle of Andalusia, for example. And the second thing is that with a COVID, again, also with like France or UK, the protection is total. I mean, you cannot evict anyone because they are not paying because of COVID. Another thing that is happening now in Barcelona is that during this 5-year contract, for example, the increase every year is kind of very small because this rate is very small. But when the contract finishes, as Christian was saying, then the jump is like crazy. And this person is basically invited to leave the flat because someone else is coming to pay twice the rent that he used or she used to pay.
In Germany, we also have these open-ended contracts, and rents can increase, for example, with the CPI or if there have been major renovations, and even under rent control, rents could increase by a certain fraction. It's limited to, I think, 15% over 3 years. So if you do not have this additional rent cap that some very tight markets have, but yeah, you can still increase the rent a little bit.
Excellent. Well, we are coming up to the end of our hour, and I want to thank all of you for doing really wonderful work with these case studies. You know, our hope was that this is going to be a good resource for people who are teaching, who are doing research in the area, for policymakers. But we felt very strongly that having some comparative information that kind of lays out the structure would be really useful to a lot of readers. Thank you guys for taking time out of your various mornings, evenings, all over the place to come and join us. I want to encourage the audience to read the full case studies. These are very detailed. There's a lot of really rich information that we didn't get a chance to go into. So please do go read those on brookings.edu. Thanks to the audience for your lively and energetic questions. Hopefully we can continue the conversation. And thanks, everybody, and have a wonderful day.